Welcome to Think Twice. I'm Dave Barber. Today the focus is on film. We will preview the upcoming Yellow Springs Film Festival with festival founder and executive director Eric Mahoney. The festival will include a celebration of the legacy of Julia Reichert. We will present a conversation with award-winning filmmaker Stephen Bognar, who shares his thoughts on the current state of art house cinema and his longtime filmmaking partner Julia Reichert. We also have conversations with the managers of our two art house cinemas, Jonathan McNeil of the Neon and Caleb Wyant from the Little Art Theater. The Yellow Springs Film Festival begins October 4th. I began by asking Eric Mahoney how the festival began.
I've been living in New York City from 2006 to the pandemic, mainly working in the film and television industry. So I was able to direct, you know, some feature films and produce others and kind of work in development and podcasting and television and kind of spent a lot of time doing those types of things, for a great deal of time and just kind of meeting a lot of great artists and connecting with them. And then when my family and I decided to move back to Yellow Springs in the midst of the pandemic, things were still very separated. Not many people were connecting in person. And I started kind of ideating about, well, when this passes, how can we sort of get back to that connectivity where we celebrate the arts together and we gather together and talk about films and music. And this village has such a rich history of those things. You know, it's part of the reason why we decided to come here is because of that history. And so, little by little, I just started to kind of plug into the art scene. I was on the board of trustees for Little Art Theater for a while. I was working over at the Bright Side to do some benefit shows with WISO and just kind of, getting back into the area. I hadn't lived here in such a long time. So it occurred to me once things were kind of back and up and running that this was a perfect setting for a film festival. I'd been to so many festivals over the years, and it was, a privilege to do so. And so many of them are in small villages. Obviously, Sundance is the most famous version of that. It's in a small town in Park City, Utah. Woodstock has a wonderful festival. Telluride is a wonderful festival. And it just started to seem like there was infrastructure here. We have a historic cinema. We have a college. And it just seemed like a place that would be perfect, the perfect setting for that. So just kind of set out to bring some interesting films and speakers to town that wouldn't otherwise be here.
It seems like there's this interest now. Not only this communal watching experience of seeing films together in theaters, we're trying to preserve that, but it seems like this single event with a talk session has become a key component of art house cinema, and it's a pretty strong component of what you're doing and a natural for a film festival, right?
Yes.
Or that may be where it all began.
Well, I think having the experience of, for the lack of a better term, kind of a bespoke experience, like speaks to people, and because of the streamers, anyone can kind of watch anything anytime. So, how do you get people out, and what motivates them? And so for us, for by and large, we have some anniversary screenings of older titles that are really cool that people like to come celebrate. But by and large, we only show films that are currently on the festival circuit, so you can't go see them anywhere else. And we also try to bring people here to speak about them because it gives the audience a chance to interact with the artist, which is very exciting. It gives young artists a chance to talk to people that they admire and get advice from them, which is very powerful, I think. We do a lot of comedy this year. Every day during the festival this year, we're having stand-up comedy. And I think that laughing again, with people is wonderful, and it's a great component to a festival. Having food trucks out and live comedy, and we're going to try and start incorporating music and things like that. All of those things can fall under the moniker of a film festival, as far as I'm concerned, because some of my favorite ones that I've been to all have those components, or art installations or things like that. So when you give people a really unique chance to have an experience that is a one-off individual experience, I think that's huge. And, more so than just leaving the theater seeing a film, which is in and of itself still a wonderful experience, to walk away having been able to ask a question to someone or to have that really unique opportunity to interact or hear from an artist directly, I think is great.
When you're planning a festival or beginning to map it out, this year's festival, What were your priorities? What were you looking to do? I know last year you had a very strong music documentary component.
Mm-hmm.
How does sort of the programming agenda for booking a festival come together?
Well, I mean, for us still, because we're so new and the infrastructure, you know, is pretty mild, you know, there's only a couple of people that really are core components to this. We're not taking submissions yet by and large. I mean, certainly people that I know personally that have friends that have made films have sent them along. But for the most part, I'm just sort of curating what I think is cool. That's all I can really say about it. You know, like, for instance, Reggie Watts. I love Reggie Watts. I think he's amazing comic, musician, great mind. And so I went after him very hard because we did Fred Armisen last year to kind of kick off the festival. And he did a music comedy component and people loved it. And so I thought, well, who else is doing those types of things? How can we, you know, kind of recreate that experience to kick off the festival in a joyous way? Films that I'd seen, you know, at Sundance, or I went out to True False this year with Steve Bognar, and we were scouting documentaries together. And so, you know, finding films there, or just kind of looking to the festivals that I really like. Tribeca is one that I think is great. South by Southwest is great. And you know, just personal relationships with people and, you know, just kind of picking what I think would resonate with people of this community, members of the village, and thinking about what I like. You know, at this point, I'd love to open it up in years to come when we have some more support and can like have people evaluate films and get submissions, because I want to champion new artists and find them. But for now, it's just sort of, you know, just thinking about what I think people would enjoy and what I enjoy.
Let's talk a little bit about this year and what you have planned for this year's festival.
Yeah, so I mentioned Reggie Watts will be our very first kickoff party. Our opening night film this year is going to be a film called The Uninvited. It's directed by Nadia Connors. It was a South by Southwest world premiere. Stars Walton Goggins, who I am a huge fan of. Nadia's work is fantastic. I read her screenplay for this 2 years ago, and I'd been kind of tracking this film ever since. And I think it's just a really beautiful, relevant piece. It also is a film that takes place over the course of one evening, which is kind of one of my favorite tropes, is to see something that kind of happens in real time and see how the characters change and emerge. The most exciting thing, I think, for me personally is a closing night will be a 25th anniversary screening of Ghost Dog, and Jim Jarmusch, the director, will be here in person to speak afterwards and do a Q&A. I started off my career interning for Jim in New York City in 2006, and we've remained friendly, and he's really been a champion of this festival, and has reached out, you know, ever since we launched it, and has always supported us and been you know, really, really cool about you know, everything that we're doing here, and is going to come this year, which I'm humbled and so grateful for. We're doing the first time we're doing an award for an emerging female documentary filmmaker in the name of Julia Reichert, which we'll be doing every year. That'll be paired with Steve Bognar's documentary Stepping Stone, Julia Stepping Stones. So we will announce our winner and screen that at the Neon, or the Neon. Of course, the Neon is in my head. The Little Art Theater. We're partnering with a company in New York City called Wavelength, who does a really interesting program every year where they give five BIPOC female or non-binary filmmakers a grant and then mentorship to make a short film. And this year we will be gathering their class from last year to showcase their work all together for the first time, which is really cool. And we'll have a panel after that. The Grand Jury Prize winner at the Sundance Film Festival, a film called In the Summers, will be here, which is a beautiful, touching piece. There's a baseball film narrative called Ephus that premiered at Cannes, director Fortnight, and will be at the New York Film Festival just prior to being here for us. The Brian Eno documentary is fantastic with the director Gary Huswit, who will be here at the Little Art Theater. That is a phenomenal, super interesting film. We're doing a 30th anniversary screening of Pulp Fiction with live music from the soundtrack and a costume contest and trivia, so that'll be a big party celebrating that film's legacy, tons of other things. I mean, we're doing a free educational seminar. I'm really, really so excited about what we have going on. So last year, we did the Foundry Theater at Antioch College, which is our larger space for kind of our in-person conversations of more notable people that are coming to town. And our stand-up comedy will all be housed at the Foundry Theater and then the Little Art Theater as well. And those will be our two venues this year. That's kind of what we're trying to sort of stay, kind of laser focused and do a very similar duration, and scale as we did last year. I'd like to really thoughtfully grow this festival, but in a very measured way. I always want to do way too much, way too soon. And it's been advised to me to, you know, continue to do this very, very well, but, you know, small as we grow. And so, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I don't want anything to go off, half-baked and have someone have kind of a mediocre experience. I want everyone that comes to anything they do here to walk away and say, wow, that was a really fantastic film or speaker or experience. So this year, again, we're going to do the two venues that run in tandem, you know, all weekend long. And then hopefully, you know, as the years go by, we will open this up and add another venue and maybe a day and just continue to kind of grow it in a very methodical way.
And the dates for the festival this year are?
October 4, 5, and 6. So the 4th is just two events. It's our kickoff party with Reggie Watts, opening night film. So it kind of starts late afternoon, goes in the evening, and then all day Saturday, you know, starting in the morning till actually we're having a midnight screening this year at the Little Art. So Saturday will go from, you know, 10:30 a.m. to 2 a.m., and then Sunday we'll run all day and all night at both those venues.
And for people that might, particularly on sort of your higher profile events, that want to make sure they're not left out, do you sell a package ticket, sell in advance, correct?
Yeah, it's a great question. So ysfilmfest.com would be the hub for everything. Our Instagram stays up to date, and we use that as our primary sort of social media focus. But yes, we do kind of two ways. There is a film badge that you can purchase that comes with like a tote bag and a t-shirt and an actual physical badge. And that gets you into the majority of events, all regular film screenings and a couple of other things on the side. And then we sort of have another bucket that's special events. That would be like opening night, closing night, the Reggie Watts, the Eno Doc. And those are just individual tickets, but one could also buy an individual ticket for anything that they wanted. So if you just go to the website, you can either kind of get a package deal, buy a one-off, do both. it's kind of up to you how you want to play it. But yes, everything is online, and it will be a kind of up and running, and you can go there and get all the information and more synopsis and details about what it is that you want to see.
When you are presenting an event this ambitious, beyond ticket sales, you surely have funders who are helping make this happen.
Absolutely. From the get, it was very, you know, imperative that we had some early adapters to this, which was amazing. And we definitely had some members of the community step up and support this financially in a very real way. And I'm eternally grateful to them. A lot of those introductions were made through the Yellow Springs Community Foundation. They're our fiscal sponsor, so we sort of operate as a nonprofit by proxy through them. And so they've offered a lot of support and guidance and have given us some grant money as well, which has been huge. And, you know, this year we also have had a lot of luck obtaining sponsorship this year, which, you know, has been really good. Year one was tough. We were on a really, really aggressive short runway and timeline. So I think a lot of sponsors were not necessarily able to or interested in doing it year one. But after we sort of had our proof of concept year, we've had so many corporate sponsors come through this year and community members and donations and things of that sort that have been, just so helpful. It doesn't run without that. And it doesn't run, I will also say, without our volunteer staff, which is an impeccable group of people that that step up and give their time, and it's a wonderful thing, and I'm very, very grateful to all of them for their help.
Eric, it sounds really exciting. I'm looking forward to being there. I know loads of people are. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. I can't wait, and I'm looking forward to seeing more people at the fest this year, and am greatly appreciative of all the love and support we've had so far. It's been really spectacular.
That was Eric Mahoney, founder and executive director of the Yellow Springs Film Festival. The festival takes place October 4th through the 6th. You can find complete information and learn more about how to purchase tickets at ysfilmfest.com. You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. Stephen Bognar is a cornerstone of the local film community. Beyond his skills as an Academy Award-winning filmmaker and teacher, he's an articulate advocate for art house cinema. We spoke about the current state of that business and the impact of streamable content, plus his assist on a recent major grant awarded to the Little Art Theater. We also discussed the legacy of his longtime partner, Julia Reichert, and how she will be celebrated at the upcoming Yellow Springs Film Festival.
Dave, I feel to my bones, I feel to the depths of my soul that the collective movie-going experience is still magic. There's something that happens when we're all together in a theater, an energy, a sort of a greater consciousness and brain that kicks in because we're together and we feel it more. We feel everything more. It's a heightened experience sort of synaptically inside of us. I don't know like biologically how it works, but I know it works. I've seen it for all my years. And we, you know, I just love that. And I think in this post-pandemic moment or era where we are not going to the movies like we used to. We don't go to the cinemas like we used to. I'm eager to remind people, and I'm grateful when people remember that there's some magic to going to the movie theater, to seeing films with strangers, to be in the dark, and also to suspend the barrage that we are surrounded by now. So you go to the movies, you're giving yourself permission to check out for 2 hours, right? It's a break. It's like entering a dream state for 2 hours. Hopefully you're in great hands. Hopefully it's an amazing story, but you don't have to do emails for those 2 hours. You don't have to check your phone, and you shouldn't check your phone for those 2 hours. And there's just the magic to that, to be sort of swept away. Not every movie sweeps us away, but the ones that do, I mean, I cherish those. I really cherish those. And the Little Art Theater and the Neon, I can still go there and be swept away. And that is an experience I adore. And it's like you can spend $200 on a big concert ticket that also sweeps you away. You go to some big arena, but a movie is like 10 bucks or 12 bucks, and it's you have that same effect, you know, of being sort of transported somewhere. And that's a really beautiful, special thing. If we look at the landscape of movies since the pandemic ended, there have been a few blockbusters, you know, Barbie and Oppenheimer, and a few others, but art house blockbusters are fewer and far between. I mean, there are occasionally some, you know, but they don't happen as often. And what you are taking out of the equation are films that don't do well but still play for a week. And they might be good films, but they're not films that resonate with audiences. And they might play to 3 or 4 people every screening at the Neon or the Little Art. And that is leaving. Like you'll preempt one night from a week-long run of some movie. You'll preempt that to have a special event where you've got a full house. So last fall, I showed a great documentary at the Neon, a film called King Coal, about the end of coal mining. We had a packed house. It was sold out. And the filmmaker, I was able to introduce the filmmaker. She's a friend of mine she lives in Tennessee. And it was like a great event and tons of energy. And it made money for the filmmaker and for the Neon, and everyone left feeling really good. The special event is the new paradigm in this post-pandemic thing where we've lost our sort of usual routine of like, hey, let's go to the movies, you know? Now, I also want to say, I'm citing the pandemic. I also think factors to our lack of collective movie going include there's more stuff on streamers than ever, right? The streamers are fighting each other to have the most content and keep us on our couch. And our TVs are bigger and bolder and better, and more of us are able to afford fancy TVs. Those things, I think, also impact movie going. But there's still nothing like watching a movie with other people. And what I love so much at the Neon or the Little Art is after the movie, talking to strangers, striking up conversations. You hear someone talking about critiquing the movie, and then I walk up to them, and suddenly we're all talking about that movie and that crazy scene that happened. And like, I love that. It's like magic.
Yeah, the night of the King Cole documentary, you had people from West Virginia who were there for the Q&A who had a personal connection.
Yeah, it was beautiful, right? It was beautiful.
Yeah. And the thing that you told me 9 years ago was that the blockbuster, the part of the film economy, just tied up so many seats. But it's interesting to me that Jonathan will still want to get just a small slice, the beginning of the Barbie run, or he'll take a film that will run in a bigger theater, but still have a window to work with it.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan is a very smart programmer. He knows his audience by now. He's been doing it for, 20 plus years. I trust his instincts. If he says, even though this film might be playing at multiplexes around the region, he still wants to show it because he knows his audience will come to the Neon, to this beautiful art house, then he's got a good instinct on that. But it's a shame. I mean, it's shameful of these distributors. They have a great art house movie that there is demand for, and they could give it to the Neon or the Little Art, the two art houses we have. They should just let those two art houses show it and don't give it to the multiplexes. And then those art houses will make money and stay in business. But what these shameful distributors do is they put it in five theaters here in Kettering and Beaver Creek and Centerville. And then it's like they're fighting, the Neon or the Little Art are fighting to keep their piece of the pie. I don't agree with that kind of philosophy or strategy.
You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. Today, the focus is on film. We're speaking with filmmaker Stephen Bognar, Yellow Springs Film Festival founder and executive director Eric Mahoney, plus the manager of the Little Art Theater, Caleb Wyant, and the manager of the Neon in downtown Dayton, Jonathan McNeil. Back to our conversation with Stephen Bognar. I asked Bognar about the short film that was created to support a major grant that the Little Art Theater received from Plex, a streaming service. Here's a portion of audio from that short film.
It's very intimate, and I really appreciate that you still get to have the sort of ticket kiosk experience where you walk up to the window and you get to wait in line and you're chatting with the folks that are around and you kind of see who else is in town.
But it's a completely different feeling here. I feel more at home here, and it's not just because I live here in the village, but because of the feel. I get the sense that everyone else that's here when I'm here feels the same way that I do. We feel at home. We're comfortable. It's just like an extension of our living room.
Everyone who works at the Little Art is super film fans and ready to talk about movies at the drop of the hat.
The selection of movies says a lot about what makes it special.
They show art house films and documentaries, movies that you're not going to see in a lot of other places.
Series like during Black History Month or Gay Pride Month.
One that I saw, I guess, last year here at the Little Art was Drive My Car. And that one I keep coming back to.
Eternal Sunshine, which was great. And I just loved it. I love that movie. I loved it at the time. It was fun to see it now, being a generation older.
The film that you created for the Little Art in this effort, the Plex grant.
It is unusual, Dave, that there's a streamer that wanted to support movie going. I did my research on who are these folks, and they actually they came up going to movie theaters, working in movie theaters, slinging popcorn like many of us. I used to do that at the Beaver Valley Cinema in Beaver Creek. It's like those of us who came up going to movies and seeing that impact, these folks at Plex seem to really get that. And so I'm really thrilled that they wanted to support the Little Art.
What exactly will the money go to specifically?
Well, I'm not involved in that, but I understand that they're going to renovate the marquee and parts of the theater and upgrade software on the projector system or stuff like that. But I'm not totally in the know. But they were awarded a $100,000 grant from the application, and the little movie that me and my friends made is part of that.
Today on Think Twice, the focus is on film. After this break, more with Stephen Bognar. You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. On October 5th at 4 p.m. at the Ellis Springs Film Festival, festival goers will have a chance to see Julia's Stepping Stones, which Stephen Bognar collaborated on with his late partner Julia Reichert. He began creating the film from Julia's own recollections, which were recorded before her passing in 2022. The festival will also present the first Julia Reichert Award, an annual prize for emerging female documentarians. Here's more of my conversation with Stephen Bognar.
Julia had a 50-year career making films. It was an amazing run. Yet her being like acknowledged outside of Dayton, Ohio, it wasn't really happening until late in her life. You know, she was diagnosed with a terminal cancer in 2018. We knew she had limited time. We didn't know how much. I mean, the doctors said she had maybe 6 months to a year to live, and that was terrifying. But she was fighting it and doing well, and we were doing the best we could. We were making American Factory. We were making our film 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. And then our friend from Chicago, Yvonne Welbin, is a great person and a great filmmaker. She asked Julia a question. She said, Julia, have you ever had a retrospective? You've been doing this for a long time. Have you ever shown your films in art museums as a retrospective, the whole body of work? And Julia said, no, that's never happened. And so Yvonne and a few other friends got the wheels turning, and pretty soon the Wexner Center for the Arts and the Museum of Modern Art were teaming up to launch a retrospective of Julia's films. She traveled the country in 2019, and a little bit in 2020, before the pandemic. She traveled the country in different cities. We showed in Portland, L.A., Minneapolis, Louisville, Cleveland, different cities, showing her works. And it was so great. I was so proud of her, and I got to see her finally getting like her whole body of work and all the through lines that run through it about women and labor and working people's stories and how important they are. All that was getting talked about and acknowledged, and big audiences were coming. And as part of that retrospective, she started doing something that she had never done. She started sharing her own story. How did a working-class girl, the daughter of a butcher and a nurse from New Jersey, how did this kid get a vision that she wanted to be a filmmaker at a time when only men could be filmmakers and only people with money could be filmmakers? How did that happen? And it's a wonderful story that leads to her discovery of photography and discovery of college and finding first person to go to college. She found Antioch College, changed her life. She found the radio station, this radio station. She found WYSO, and that helped her find her voice. She tells this story beautifully, and she would tell it in front of audiences, and it was so good. Knowing that her time was limited, I started asking her, like, we got to do a good recording of this, like a good audio recording, not just in front of an audience, but like up close and, you know, personal. And she said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. One of these days, we'll do it. And she kept putting it off because, of course, we were busy and she was like bashful about it. But I kept bugging her about it. But she still wouldn't do it. And then one day my birthday was coming up and she said, totally separate, she said, what do you want for your birthday, honey? And I paused. And I said, honey, I want you to record your talk, your story for my birthday. That's my birthday present, is you do a good recording of your story. And so she couldn't say no. And then we did it, and it was beautiful. It's a beautiful recording. And I kept that in the bank, knowing that, like, you know, while she was still alive, we weren't going to do anything with it. But then after she died, I pulled it out and listened to it. And my wheel started turning that maybe it's a film. Maybe it could be a film. And I started playing with it. This is early 2023. And I, you know, I'm in a state of deep grief. I'm missing her terribly. And so hearing her voice was therapeutic, hard but comforting. And I started thinking about, well, what archival photos, what family photos, what archival movies, what cultural, pop cultural references could go with this? And I just started playing with it in early 2023. And then my friends in Missouri at the True False Film Festival and the University of Missouri, they invited me to like share something. And I said, well, I've got this piece about Julia that I'm maybe something. And they're like, they said to me, it doesn't matter how rough it is. Why don't you come and show it? And I did. This was March 2023. It was the first time anyone saw it. And the response was, A, there's really something there. B, it needs a lot of work. It's really rough. And I got tons of great feedback from my filmmaking friends. And then I really started working. I dove in. And then basically throughout 2023, I crafted it. I honed it. I did test screenings. And I learned how to make it work as a movie. Because her telling a story is one thing, but a movie is another thing. It's like they're different forms. And then basically by the end of 2023, early 2024, it was done. It was a film that I felt like could show in front of an audience that had an arc that was well made, and it had been through the test, the process, the forge to make it good. And now it's showing. Now it's out in the world, and I'm really thrilled. And it's showing. So the story that Julia tells ends with her and Jim Klein making their first movie, which became Growing Up Female, which is a landmark documentary. It's still in distribution. It's on the National Film Registry of the Library of Congress. It's a classic film. And yet they were kids. They were Antioch students making their first film. They did not know how to operate a camera. And they made this incredible movie that is now 54 years old and stood the test of time. And that film, Growing Up Female, pairs really well with the film about Julia, which is called Julia's Stepping Stones.
When she started, were you there sort of prodding her, or did she start and stop that on her own?
Oh, her story, her telling of her own story? No, she did that all on her own. I mean, I gave edit notes. Like, we always give each other notes. But, no, that is her work and her creation. And she's really the co-maker of this
right.
film. And we are the directors together. It's our last, I mean, it's hard to say it, but it's our last collaboration.
One of the fascinating parts was she's given the work, particularly unions, the working class. Very interesting to see the Antioch side of it, where she's the daughter of a New Jersey butcher. She comes to Antioch, and she's sizing up her classmates are rather affluent.
She's feeling really inadequate. She's feeling ashamed. She did not want to say her dad was a butcher, so at a grocery store. So she lied. She said when all the girls, the young women, were going around saying what their families did, and other young women are like, oh, my dad's a lawyer, my dad's a doctor, Julia lied and said her dad was the manager of a grocery store. She couldn't even admit that her dad was just like was a butcher, not just a butcher, but a butcher. That's fascinating, this sense of class shame and how she eventually realized that she couldn't even see it, right? She couldn't put a name to that, but she got over it. This is part of the gifts that Antioch gave her, and also that the 60s gave her about class and gender and race, is that she's like, oh, we need a just world, a fair world and a just world and a better world. You know, your race and your gender and your class background and whatever, you know, it shouldn't just be run by rich white men.
In Julia's Stepping Stones, we see her taking Growing Up Female, her first film, which was done with Jim Klein, out on tour on a Greyhound bus.
She had one film print. They could only afford one 16-millimeter film print of the movie that they had worked on. And she would literally take it on a Greyhound bus and go to different cities and show it. And then, you know, try to make a little money so she could go to the next city and get names on a mailing list. And eventually they had enough mailing list names that they created like a pamphlet and started distributing the film. But for that first long stretch, it was literally her on a Greyhound with a clanky can of film reels.
I carried one 16-millimeter print around on a Greyhound bus to find its audience. I went to Cleveland, Ohio. First, I called a handful of friends who were in the women's movement up there, who agreed to set up a projector and a screen and a sound system and invite a few other women's movement people to come together in a living room to watch the film. And they would say, "Oh, we have to show this film to others." And they would set up a second screening in their city, in a church basement, in a classroom, so more people would see it. Every time, I got people's name and address. I would then ask him, "Where do you know other people in the women's movement? Other people who you'd think should see this in other towns?"
The idea that you can do it, you don't need permission, you don't need to know all the rules, you don't need to train in some hermetic environment before you're out in the world stumbling your way forward to make meaningful work. And that's an ethos Julia carried all her life and shared with everybody, that you can't just stay in a safe place and try to practice making good work. You gotta get out there. You gotta take your knocks, and you'll say the wrong thing in front of someone, or you'll get a bad shot, or you'll forget to load the film in the camera, or you'll turn off the recorder when you thought it was rolling and in fact you had stopped it because it was already rolling. All the stupid mistakes that we all make. Like, she was brilliant at saying, like, don't let any of that stop you. Don't let fear stop you. Get out into the world.
That's Stephen Bognar. The film we discussed, Julia's Stepping Stones, will be presented along with the first annual Julia Reichert Award to an emerging female documentary filmmaker at the Yellow Springs Film Festival, Saturday, October 5th at 4 p.m. at the Little Art Theater. You can learn more at ysfilmfest.com. You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. After this break, we will be back with Jonathan McNeil, manager of the Neon in downtown Dayton. For over a quarter century, Jonathan McNeil has been the driving force behind the Neon, downtown Dayton's art house cinema. His 60-hour work week includes curating its schedule of film showings and special events while developing the theater as a community hub. Sitting down to talk, I reference back to a Community Voices story I created 8 years ago on the impact of streamable content. I started by asking Jonathan about what has changed since then, post-pandemic.
Well, it's an interesting relationship that we have with streaming. Everything changed during COVID. Streaming platforms quadrupled or more as far as availability of content and the number of applications that people have in their homes. From, you know, the introduction of Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and so many others, in addition to the big ones like Netflix and Amazon. So things have changed quite a bit. Our relationships with some of those distributors have changed as well. Netflix actually does not make every film available theatrically, but they make their films that are award season bound available to us. So a film like Maestro, there's any number of films that if they're looking for a big Oscar campaign, they're going to want us to play it. And also during COVID, when there were so few titles, new films being made, Netflix ended up being a partner for us and ended up giving us newer content that the distributors didn't have or weren't willing to put into the marketplace yet. So we ended up kind of creating an interesting relationship with some of the streaming services from a distribution standpoint. Sometimes that's before they're streaming, and sometimes that's maybe day and date with a streaming service. So a film becomes available to us the same day that it's on Apple Plus, but there's still sometimes a lack of new content that we feel will make a draw here or be of interest to the community. So we still end up showing some of those films. Now, if it's on a streaming platform like Netflix, it becomes a big question. Do we play those films? They often don't do that well unless they're of the caliber that are, you know, the films that our customers really want to see on the big screen. And it's a challenge. It's to figure out which of those will work and which won't. And we've certainly tried some and failed and tried some and had success. So it's a dance. Now there's so much content. The marketplace is flooded with content and flooded with platforms that I feel as though there's a lot of really bad content finding homes on streaming services. And streaming services are starting to flounder. I mean, there are so many out there that so many of them have had difficulty finding their niche and finding sustainability. So I think that in some way that will help us because some of those streaming services will disappear.
It was interesting to go back and listen to the audio that I had with Jenny Calperthwaite. At the time, Jenny told me 8 years ago that she was already starting to see audiences gravitate to comedies and period dramas, but perhaps a little less to dramas. Is there a type of movie that you feel is doing particularly well, or a type of movie that's maybe taken a bit of a hit because of all this?
I'd have to agree with that sentiment from 8 years ago, and maybe even more so. The heavier, the harder hitting films are more of a challenge to get audiences for. But maybe that's always been the case, or at least for the last decade or more. I mean, there was an advent of the art house cinema in the 70s where people were really embracing international titles and intellectual titles, but they were still a very niche part of the movie-going environment. So I don't think that that's changed much. It's still niche. It's still people looking for really kind of heady dramas is a challenge to find an audience for. We do better with lighter, heartwarming period dramas, like you said, those kind of costume pieces that people are interested in, maybe a biopic. Even hearing right now at the Venice Film Festival, the biggest headline right now is Angelina Jolie playing Maria Callas. So, I mean, those people still want to see those kinds of films, and something that they're familiar with. Familiarity helps a lot. The biopic is a genre that still works in some regard. You know, our biggest films of the year have been Thelma with June Squibb, a sweet and charming, lighthearted, but also, you know, people can find themselves in it. They can find a connection to it. It's about, you know, a phone scam, about an older woman getting phone scammed and trying to get her money back. June Squibb, age 94, getting her first lead role. Our audiences loved it. It played for 7 weeks, which we've hardly had any films over the last 4 years since COVID play with any longevity like that. My Penguin Friend, a really heartwarming little film about a man who rescues a penguin from an oil spill, based on a true story that was a viral sensation. The penguin travels 5,000 miles every year to visit his friend who saved him from the oil spill. There's a heart-tugging connection, and those are the films that are working for us. We still see some dramas, but still they have to have an aspect of comedy to really do well, like The Holdovers. You know, it's those kinds of films that have the legs to do more than a week of business.
Is it still the case where a single run or two or three really big movies can make a difference in an annual budget? Are you still in that situation post-COVID?
So we have, post-COVID, looked toward a couple more mainstream titles to help us, not only with bottom line box office, but just reminding people that we're here and sometimes just getting new people in the door and then exposing them to the trailer set that we have before the show that they're seeing. So we played Elvis, Baz Luhrmann from Warner Brothers. We played Barbie, and that was an interesting choice. We had to play. I knew we needed something that summer that was going to be big. There was Oppenheimer. There was Barbie. Nobody had seen either film yet. You had to book it based on gut instinct. And we decided, you know, we hadn't played a Christopher Nolan film since Memento 20 plus years ago, because all of his stuff was mainstream after that. But we had played everything Greta Gerwig has done and watched her essentially grow up on screen as an actress as well. So it felt like the absolute right thing to watch this woman's career, see what she does next in a big studio setting. And it was a big hit for us. It cost a lot, but you know, as far as, you know, we pay a percentage of box office back to the distributor, and it was a hefty sum back to the distributor, but we got a lot of people in the door, and they saw the trailers for what we had coming down the road. They saw that it is a more community-centered space, good customer service, great popcorn, all those things that people want in a movie theater, and the projection is good, and the sound is good, and we won some new customers over that way.
Is your methodology still the same in terms of when we talked 8 years ago, you were using a buyer and you were also attending, there was sort of a division of labor in there, and that you would go out to see movies and to scout movies yourself, but also use a buyer? Is that still the model you use?
That is still the model. We're still using that model. Our buyer is out of Oakland. She and I talk on the phone maybe once every 6 or 8 weeks at length, but then it's multiple emails on a weekly basis. She usually sees most of what's playing at Sundance. I see a lot of what's playing at the Toronto International Film Festival. I went back last year for the first time during COVID, and we'll go back again this year. Last year I saw 35 films over the course of 9.5 days, and saw the holdovers there, brought that back, saw, you know, even Lee, which we're bringing not until the end of September this year. So a lot of those films sometimes are looking for distribution, and Lee is about a Vogue photographer who became a photographer during World War II. So once again, there you go, a period drama with Kate Winslet, you know, we have an audience.
When I came down for the Julia Riker double bill, as you were introducing the films, you mentioned that night that you had done over 50 single event films. That's become a bigger part of your model here, right?
50 kind of one night only events. So maybe it's a documentary about a particular musician, or maybe it's a documentary about, you know, Reading Rainbow, where we had it was called Butterfly in the Sky. We showed the documentary about the famous PBS show Reading Rainbow, and then had a group of literary scholars talking about literacy rates and what we can do to improve literacy. So we try to find different ways to create excitement and energy and enthusiasm and community and those kinds of things with film here. And that's what's really been driving our business lately. It's the exhibition on screen screenings with the Dayton Art Institute, where we look at a particular artist's documentary and then have someone from the Dayton Art Institute come and chat afterward. Fills the house. And it's those that can save an entire week for us, filling the house one time with a slightly elevated special event ticket price. It's that kind of stuff that is saving us right now. The day-to-day operations are, you know, we see some successes here and there, but it takes a lot of work. And the special events take a lot of work. Just finding that niche audience, doing the marketing campaign, you know, whatever. But I know that for some of these things, the one time only is the only way to go, because they wouldn't work 4 times a day for an entire week.
That was Jonathan McNeil, manager of the Neon in downtown Dayton. You can learn more about the Neon and its current schedule at neonmovies.com. You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. The Neon and the Little Art Theater are now both nonprofit organizations, which puts each theater in a position to pursue money to help subsidize day-to-day operations. Caleb Wyant is manager of the Little Art Theater. I spoke with Caleb about the recent major grant the theater received from the streaming platform Plex and what programming is working for the Little Art Theater in the post-COVID era.
There was a lot of great publicity around the short film that Stephen Bognar created when you went for the grant from Plex. Well, can you tell me a little bit about how you found out about that and
sure.
How you were able to make this such a success?
Well, you know, that was our our head of development, and she had found, her name's Catherine Ekstrand. She had heard about this grant and said, "I really think we should try to get this." And you know, so we met with Steve with the idea of just kind of picking his brain on how do we make a video. And by the end of the little meeting, he was volunteering, "I'll shoot this thing." So you're not going to say no. And the local Academy Award winner is asking, or, you know, saying that he can do it for you. So, of course. But yeah, we took it very seriously, and we got it all together and planned it all out and submitted it. And yeah, it was just amazing, the whole process.
With that grant, I've been told that a new marquee is part of the mix for the way you may utilize that money. Mm-hmm. What makes up the budget of a theater like the Little Art? I mean, you have concessions, ticket sales, special events. At this point, how much fundraising needs to be done around running an operation like the Little Art Theater?
A significant amount of the money that we bring in is through the kindness of loyal donors who have donated to the theater for an extremely long time, and then reaching out and finding new donors. And so that's a substantial amount. As far as grants are, as far as I know, it seems like a relatively new venture for us. Historically, I wouldn't say grants are a substantial part because it's kind of new for us, but I could see it being a pretty substantial part moving forward for sure.
For the Little Art Theater post-pandemic, what programming seems to be working out best here at the theater?
When we first reopened, we did like a little Hitchcock series. It started to roll into, well, we're open regular shows Friday through Monday. Let's see if Thursday can be like a throwback day. And so we just kept continuing these series. It's one of my favorite parts of the job is to come up with these different themes, and can be anything. So we had like musicals. We do like a horror series, obviously, at Halloween time and through October. The one that we just came off of was movies about bands. So it was A Hard Day's Night and the Scott Pilgrim movie I had mentioned earlier. And then we also occasionally going back and doing like a filmmaker series, because those tend to seem to get people pretty excited. And so we did a Wes Anderson one that was pretty successful. This year we've done Coen Brothers, which did pretty well. And then here in September we're going to have Stanley Kubrick.
So with the Friends of the Little Art Theater, this base of donors that are behind you, this grant you've received, how are you feeling about sort of the future of the theater as we continue on into this crazy era where there's just so much content in every direction? How are you feeling about the future of the Little Art Theater?
Feeling pretty good. I think the turnouts have been pretty consistent. We start, especially with those throwback series, we see like a lot of the same folks are coming, and that's been expanding. And depending on what you're showing to, and we did like our adventure series, we showed the Goonies and people came from 4 hours away, a whole, you know, 8-person family came. And so those things, you know, those are starting to fill out more and more and become a recognizable thing that we do. But we're also, you know, expanding just programming in general. Like we have local artist Kylene Downs is playing in September. We're in talks with a couple other bands. So there's things like that that we're trying to do to make it a little bit beyond just films. The Little Art Theater has kind of always been that way, but we just like to make that more of a regular thing. So I do feel I do feel positive about the theater in general. And as far as the streaming landscape and the way it affects films, it's sort of it limits you sometimes of what you can show. But at the same time, the people, a lot of the services that are streaming movies, like say Warner Brothers with, you know, Max, formerly HBO Max, they're also putting movies in movie theaters as well. So they're self-competing a little bit, but at the same time, I think they're working more in tandem than what maybe the average person thinks. So it might just be, instead of a movie lasting all summer like it used to, you know, a movie in the 90s would come out, say, The Sixth Sense, and it would be in film, you know, it would be in theaters for months and months. That window is shorter now. But also the way that we program, we're usually only showing a film for about a week to 2 weeks. So it doesn't really affect us in that sense. You just have to be on guard and ready to, okay, we'll think about three or four films in advance. But I think the movie theater experience is something that it waxes and wanes. But no, I'm not not anything but optimistic about it.
Caleb, thanks a lot for talking to me today on Think Twice.
Yeah, not a problem.
You've been listening to Think Twice on WYSO. Special thanks to Caleb Wyant, Jonathan McNeil, Eric Mahoney, and Stephen Bognar. You can learn more about The Neon at neonmovies.com, The Little Art Theater at littleart.com, and the Yellow Springs Film Festival at ysfilmfest.com. My name's Dave Barber. Thanks for listening.